The next case this morning is 5-24-1351, People versus Freeman. Arguing for the appellant is Jennifer Lassie. Arguing for the appellee is Stephanie Lee. Each side will have 10 minutes for their argument. The appellant will also have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Please note only the clerk of the court is permitted to record these proceedings today.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Ms. Lassie, if you are ready to begin, you may do so.
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Jennifer Lassie with the Office of the State Appellate Defender, and I represent the defendant appellant, Mr. Dante Freeman. If time permits, I will be addressing both arguments raised in the opening and reply brief. First, the state failed to go to trial within the appropriate statutory speedy trial period, and the trial court abused its discretion in granting many of the state's motions to continue. To be clear, the state filed motions to continue in February, April, May, June, August, and September. And Mr. Freeman did not challenge the motion filed in February. It's important to note that the provision for DNA testing was not meant to provide an automatic continuance in every trial that involves DNA testing. Such a result would be absurd and would allow the state to double the speedy trial period in every case involving DNA. That doesn't make sense. That's why the statute requires the state to prove that it's exercised due diligence. Also, it cannot be overlooked that NM and NS both disclosed their allegations against Mr. Freeman before the first charges, the ones involving NM, were even filed on January 23rd, 2024. Mr. Freeman was taken into custody on January 19th, 2024, and he remained in custody until his trial began more than 9 months later on October 28th, 2024. Whether the state has proved its exercise due diligence is reviewed for an abuse of discretion, but the overall issue of whether a defendant's speedy trial rights have been violated is reviewed de novo. First, the state argues that there was no speedy trial violation since it brought Mr. Freeman to trial within the extra time it obtained. That ignores the fact that these extensions after the February one never should have been granted. The state also suggests that it was Mr. Freeman's burden to sever the charges. However, that argument goes against all reason. The state chose to bring the charges for NS in the same case as NM, and the state wasn't required to do that. The state bears the burden of bringing a defendant to trial within that statutory timeline, not the defense. And it's not Mr. Freeman's fault that the state's poor choices on how to charge this case hindered the state's ability to bring him to trial within the required time frame. This court, in the Battles case cited in the briefing, made it clear that the state bears the burden of demonstrating it exercised due diligence. On appeal, the state continues to do what it did below. It makes these bald assertions that it exercised due diligence without ever explaining how it did so. So, for example, with respect to locating witnesses in the Ely case cited in the briefing, the state made extensive efforts to get witnesses for months and made numerous attempts to locate them and to serve them with subpoenas. Here, in July, the state asked for more time to present witnesses at its 115-10 hearing. And then in August, the state shows up and says, the day before, we learned that Lopez wasn't available and we never subpoenaed her. So the state never even served one of its critical witnesses with a subpoena. Instead, it just hoped that she would show up. And then the state learned the day before the hearing that she wasn't able to do so and that she was on medical leave. That's not due diligence. With respect to obtaining DNA evidence, this court explained in Battles that the state is required to tender a full explanation of each and every step taken to complete DNA testing, and the step should articulate a course of action that a reasonable and prudent person, intent upon completing the test within 120 days, would follow. And the showing should also explain why the efforts engaged in fell short of their objective and why it resulted in an unavoidable delay. Here, we just have the state making a conclusory assertion in its filings below, we've exercised due diligence, but it doesn't really explain how. And the state's brief on appeal also doesn't because it's just not in the record and they can't. So we asked this court to find that the state did not demonstrate due diligence as required. The trial court erred in granting those extensions other than the initial February 1. And we also argue that trial counsel was ineffective for failing to file a pretrial motion to dismiss those charges, which brings me to the second argument. Trial counsel was ineffective for failing to file that pretrial motion. Illinois law requires attorneys to file a written motion to dismiss prior to trial. And if they fail to do so, they waive the issue. And here, trial counsel recognized that there was a speedy trial issue, objecting every step of the way and raising the issue orally before the trial court. And trial counsel also raised the issue in a post-trial motion. And during the Krenkel inquiry, trial counsel was clear that he thought there was a speedy trial issue, but then based on the court's rulings, he didn't think he could file a motion. That's just a misunderstanding of the law. Trial counsel was required to file that written motion, and counsel just simply misunderstood what he was supposed to do. And it's clear that counsel thought there was a speedy trial violation because counsel raised the issue again in a post-trial motion, which demonstrates that counsel believed the argument had merit. I mean, otherwise, counsel's prohibited from raising frivolous filings by Supreme Court Rule 137. So when we look at the trial court's inquiry for argument two, it is manifestly erroneous. Trial counsel made it clear that there was a speedy trial issue to be raised. And trial counsel also made it clear that he just misunderstood the procedural requirements for raising that argument properly. So the trial court's ruling and failure to appoint new counsel was manifest error. One other thing I wanted to address with this argument, the state argues that this is a repackaging of the speedy trial argument raised in argument one, but it's not. When counsel fails to do something properly, the only way to reach the issue to avoid waiver or forfeiture is to assert that counsel was ineffective. So it's not a repackaging of any claim. It's the way the claim must be raised. And I would also ask this court to find that this is not an attempt to use the speedy trial statute as a sword, as the state suggests. The cases cited by the state are cases where counsel and the defendant repeatedly acquiesce to continuance motions, and then in the post-trial stage, raise the issue of speedy trial violations. And that's not what we have here. This issue was raised repeatedly. So this is not the speedy trial statute being used as a sword. This was just ineffective assistance and a failure to follow the code of criminal procedure. So it's entirely distinct from the cases cited by the state. So unless this court has any questions, we would ask you to reverse Mr. Freeman's convictions outright under argument one, or alternatively, as requested in argument two, we would ask that you reverse the trial court's judgment with respect to the Krenkel inquiry and remand for further proceedings with the appointment of new counsel.
Okay, thank you. Justice Vaughn, Justice Clark, any questions?
Yeah, just a question, please. Absent some finding that the trial court abused its discretion in granting the motions, what harm did the defense suffer by the counsel not filing his motion to dismiss? If the continuances were not an abuse of discretion, what difference does it make?
So if this court would find that the trial court did not abuse its discretion in granting these, then Mr. Freeman would not be able to show the prejudice required. However, it is our position that the trial court did abuse its discretion in granting all of the motions for continuance other than the February one.
Thank you.
No questions for me. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Ms. Lassie, you'll have time in rebuttal. Ms. Lee?
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, counsel, Stephanie Lee on behalf of the people. The defense seems to be conflating two different issues. And the first would be what would be a claim of sort of trial court error reviewed under an abuse of discretion, which What the defense attorney explained was he was preserving that, and the court during the Krenkel hearing made it very clear he understood that. So what was preserved was the idea that of the argument that the trial court abused its discretion by finding due diligence. What is absolutely waived and is binding on this court is the concept that there was some sort of actual violation, and there isn't one within this extended speedy trial period as granted under the statute. So on October 17th, when you look at Supplemental Record 21 and 22, what you'll see is the defense counsel specifically conceded that if it went to trial on October 28th, it was within the speedy trial period. So there was, in fact, no violation. What got litigated at the post-trial motion, and the court had said to the defendant, that's what we're going to talk about at the post-trial motion, which is the due diligence piece. The court listened, heard. We actually had a person from the lab come and testify and outline all the steps that also had been done. And so after hearing all that, the court found again due diligence. That is what your court, this court can look at. If your honors want to, the problem for defense there is it has to be that the court's decision was actually arbitrary, unreasonable. No reasonable judge would have made that finding. And I don't think, and if your honors were to disagree, that you may not have granted any, it isn't multiple motions. And that you can see when you look at the Pettis. If you look at page 60, 59 and 60 of the Pettis case, it actually talks about best practices in that court's opinion. It didn't say what was required. But what it said is it is a good idea to bring them up, give the status, what's going on, here's where we're at, and you still get a single 120 extension. So these really weren't multiple 120 extensions. There was a 60, which was for the missing witness. And to the extent that the defense wants to say that the lack of a subpoena is somehow important to that issue, there's no cite for that, number one. And number two, it was a medical unexpected thing to leave the day before. So the fact of the matter is, it wasn't that she didn't show up because she wasn't under subpoena. You couldn't have done, or even if you did do a rule to show cause for not showing up, she was in, medical leave. So, and then she did, of course, show up once she was available. So the subpoena is not why she didn't show up. That's a non-starter issue. To the extent that counsel in reply has said that we waived Strickland, absolutely with that. On page 617 of our brief, we explain why, number one, you cannot file a meritless motion, and number two, so that there was no prejudice and also no deficient performance for not filing what would be a meritless motion. Again, as far as, well, the other thing that is interesting here is it's been said that, well, the DNA for the NS was done on a certain date, and the DNA for NM was done on a certain date. The defense concedes that all of this would have been 7.3 in evidence at a minimum. So the fact of the matter is, it was material evidence to both cases. But you also have a situation here where you have one pink vibrator, which has DNA from both victims and the defendant, and apparently one of the victim's brothers and one of the victim's mother. So the DNA as to either of these victims was never complete until you finished and analyzed all of this mix of a very complicated DNA case. And Pitchford explained in her trial testimony, really, and her testimony at the post-trial motion hearing. The state's position is that this would be defendant using the the speedy trial as a sword as opposed to a shield. What you have here is absolutely overwhelming evidence of his guilt. Trying to, after the fact, get an outright reversal of his conviction. And again, in a very, very, very complicated DNA case with five, at least five relevant people having DNA on this single vibrator that obviously defendant used to abuse these two girls. We also, as to the motion to sever, we have never and are not arguing that, oh, if we had sev if defendant had moved to sever, we wouldn't have violated the speedy trial. The reason we're not arguing that is point blank because there is no violation. So severing isn't, it's not that it, if defendant had severed, it wouldn't have been violated. It wasn't violated. It was within the time frame. So we do have the burden to try defendant in the speedy trial term. We absolutely met that burden by filing the, you know, filing, staying on top of it, and trying him within the extended trial time as was set by the trial court. I do find it interesting that defense is not even only a persuasive has not addressed Hampton. From this court, it's right on point in terms of trying to repackage some sort of a violation argument into an ineffective assistance. But here we actually have the defense attorney explaining, I didn't file it because we went to trial within the time allowed by the court. So what would be available would be an argument that the court abused its discretion in extending that period of time. But there's no evidence of that here. Each and every court date, the court made the finding. I've reviewed the filings, which included affidavits from officer of the court, the state's assistant state's attorney, explaining all the steps that had been gone through. I would like to address briefly the Battles case, which is obviously from this court. Your colleagues on the second and fourth have both rejected Battles as a specific test. And you can see that in the Curry case from the second. They cite themselves rejecting that test. And they also cite the fourth rejecting the test. Also, I'm aware it just came out Friday, but if you choose to look, there would be another case from the fourth rejecting Battles as a specific test or affirming that. The Rule 23s, and I understand that, but not Curry. Curry is not a Rule 23. And let me, if I could have just a minute. Last, I just really want to emphasize the materiality of the DNA affected both cases. And until it was completed, it was not completed for both. And as soon as it's clear that it's a 7.3 evidence, regardless, it's very clear that there was no violation there. Anyway, but also, defendant did in fact say that he agreed that it should be tried together, even though everybody agrees it's not compulsory joinder. So the litigation strategy did change the analysis to a certain extent, although the evidence still would have been needed for both. But we're not claiming that defendant had was obligated to sever in order for us not to violate Speedy. We didn't violate Speedy, and that is our point. I think, let me. And that, unless there are other questions, I think that would be my present from this. We would ask the court to affirm.
Okay, thank you. Justice Vaughn, Justice Clark, any questions?
No, thank you.
Have any questions? Thank you.
All right, thank you, Mrs. Lee. Ms. Lassie, you have time.
Thank you, Your Honor. First, I would like to address the state's reference to a case from the fourth that came out this Friday. This is a case, I'm not sure which one the state's referring to, but also it's not cited in the briefing, and so it's improper to ask the court to consider it at this stage, which is oral argument. Next, I would like to address the state's first argument about the Mr. Freeman conflating the issues with respect to what was raised and preserved regarding the speedy trial count, the speedy trial claim. So with the speedy trial violation, trial counsel can't just preserve the argument that the trial court abused its discretion without also filing that pre-trial motion to dismiss the charges. The state seems to be arguing that counsel was preserving the issue of whether the state exercised due diligence, but counsel failed to preserve the issue of that there was a speedy trial violation. And that doesn't make sense. In order to argue that there was a speedy trial violation and that the state failed to exercise due diligence, which led to the speedy trial violation, counsel was required to file that pretrial motion. So if you find that this was an abuse of discretion, counsel absolutely erred in failing to file that motion. The statute's clear on that. It's got to be filed pretrial or the issue is waived. So counsel can't preserve the issue in part and not preserve the issue in part. The next point, the state argues that trial counsel conceded to an extension into October. I believe the state's referring to pages 268 and 269 in the report of proceedings. But if you look at that in context, counsel's not agreeing to an extension. What counsel is saying is, as long as you're going to go to trial within the time that the court has already granted and that you're not asking for more, then fine. And at that point, counsel's saying, the court's already denied things that I've fought against. If you're going within that period that I've already fought for and, you know, been rejected on, that's fine, but I'm not agreeing to more time. So I don't think that's a concession. Counsel already fought that battle and lost. So that's not an acquiescence to a continuance. One of the other points the state made, I thought there was a question.
I don't believe so.
One of the other points the state made was that there's no law saying a subpoena is required for witnesses. That's not the argument being made. So when we look at the Ealy case, E-A-L-Y, cited in the briefing, in that case, getting a subpoena was part of the demonstration that due diligence happened. But that's just part of it. In the Ealy case, the state demonstrated that it had made extensive efforts over a 7-month period to try to locate witnesses and try to subpoena them to force them to come to court. Here, yes, the state said its witness Lopez had a medical issue, but the problem is the state didn't exercise due diligence because it learned that its witness had a medical issue the day before the hearing. So that's not an exercise of due diligence where the state doesn't know the information about its witnesses until the day before hearing. So it had the state subpoenaed its witnesses, communicated with them to inform them of the upcoming hearing. That would be due diligence. And again, that August 9th hearing, the state learned the day before August 8th that Lopez wouldn't be available, but that hearing was already continued from July. So the state had from July 16th until August 8th, and it didn't learn anything about Lopez until August 8th, I guess, presumably reaching out the day before the hearing to see if Lopez would show up. And that's just not due diligence when we look at cases like Ealy and Battles. And finally, an important point, the state argued it below and the state continues to argue it on appeal. This additional DNA testing regarding the brother has nothing to do with the charges filed here. The DNA testing, as claimed by the state, for NM and NS was complete in, I believe, June and August. And still the state failed to present its case properly and get its witnesses and its evidence to trial until October. And this, the male DNA is simply a red herring. It's a distraction and it's irrelevant to the charges filed in this case. So we would ask this court to reverse his convictions outright or remand for the Krenkel or remand for the appointment of new counsel as an argument too.
Okay.
Unless your honors have questions.
Justice Clark, Justice Vaughn, any questions?
No, thank you.
No questions. Thank you.
Okay, seeing no questions are going to be asked, thank you both for your arguments here today, as well as your briefs. The court will take the matter into consideration and issue its ruling in due course.